Welcome to the Adam Savage Project. I'm Adam.
I'm Norm.
And I'm Joey.
Joey.
Hey.
Hello.
Morning.
How are you guys
morning.
Doing?
Good. I'm doing all right. Yeah. Yeah. It's. I think last week was a little crazy. You know, we had a big site relaunch. We talked a little bit about when we after our podcast last week. I had a sick kid. We also, announced another kid. So it was a pretty eventful week.
Your kid announcement made the front page of Reddit.
It did.
Did it really?
Yeah.
Congratulations on both those things.
I don't know which one I'm more excited about. 115,000 upvotes or having the kid in, you know, in half a year from now. I mean, I'm not the one having the kid. What can I redeem those points for?
Exactly.
Nothing. Yeah.
I may never call upon them, but one day.
You know, it's funny. They called people who, if you are in the club, the club, quote unquote, I'm using air quotes here, of people who've made the front page, it's the Eternity Club.
The Eternity Club?
The Eternity Club. Huh. That's like, it's something you'll be able to live on that forever.
So about probably 7 or 8 years ago, I have two very good friends who are both tenured professors at Cal. And they're both super crazy smart. I mean, when I'm around them, I'm just trying to keep up. But they also tended to sometimes be, as you could imagine, somewhat ignorant of popular culture. So at one point they were like, we've become fascinated with this thing called Reddit. Are you aware of it? Oh, no. I said, yeah, I am. And they're like, good, because you seem to be their uncrowned king. This is like peak of Mythbusters when I was showing up on the front page of Reddit like every other week, and my friends were just like, what is Adam doing over here?
When worlds collide. Absolutely. Yeah. We're all in our little internet silos. So we're gonna do a spoiler cast this week.
Kind of.
We want to dive deep. We were talking about movies, and it's a funny thing because obviously we can't go to theaters, and there are some movies being released. It's always weird when I see, you know, a big film dropped on Netflix or on Amazon Prime. I'm like, when do they make this? And then, like, you can sometimes tell from the technology, even on like the Apple TV show, it's like, oh, you know, it's an Apple show. They're going to use the newest tech, but they're all using iPhone, like, 10s's.
Oh, so you're looking at the technology in camera.
Yeah, they're filmed in 2018. Now, not only are they hugging each other, they're using older iPhones.
Well, right? I mean, and then in the case of like the Indian matchmaking, so it feels like that show, like sometime in March, they're like, oh crap, just edit what we got and get it out.
Right. Yeah.
I wonder how much of things are being pulled out of the archive from like years past that they've been sitting on, how much stuff was just almost done that they just rushed through. It's interesting.
Well, there has to be a huge roster because every time you look at the IMDb of anybody you like, there's at least like half a dozen movies you've never heard of in Gary Oldman's filmography. And you're like, when did he do that? Or, you know, Kate Hudson. You're like, I never heard of this film. And it's like some direct-to-video thing.
I've seen actors like, I can't remember the off the top of my head, but there has been actors who kind of blew up and then they start pulling those movies out that they've been sitting on that they'd never released for some reason or another and like got the rights to whatever that they're kind of waiting on. But just
Chris Hemsworth. Famously with the remake of Red Dawn.
Was that what
they filmed and shelved. And then once he got Thor'd, they pulled that out and there you go. Here's a Chris Hemsworth leading film. But, you know, post takes a long time. I'm sure you know, Joey, and some of these films are shot in like 4 to 6 weeks. And so production just happens, right? It's still going on.
I'm not going to lie. I do miss, like, I never thought I'd say this, but like, I miss just having that Marvel movie to look forward to. I mean, I know that phase is done, but also I miss going to the theater and like seeing the bigger budget stuff and just having a good time. I mean, I was going to the theater like every other week. So like, that's a
big change. I have been finding, and this is germane to what we're going to talk about today, like I've been finding there are movies that I have continually gone back to just for the comfort of sitting through their awesome. And the last hour of Endgame is one I've probably, like literally, I think it's minute 100. If you start there, that's Avengers Assemble. That's the Thanos fight, the first Thanos fight with all of them. And then Avengers Assemble. And I just watched all the way through the end, probably 8 or 9 times so far during COVID.
The music for everything at that point, from the portal scene to the death scene, that's it's all so good.
Yeah, it was great.
there's just there's a yeah, it feels like a weirdly safe space because the action is so weirdly clear given what a giant mess of a scene it could easily be.
I mean, that whole thing, that whole Marvel franchise, how easily it could have just gone to hell. Like, just to wrap your as filmmakers, to wrap your mind around that many moving elements and moving parts and moving actors, like A-list actors, and make it all work the way they did. I mean, whether you like those movies or not, like, the fact that they were able to do what they did is just mind-blowing.
Can you unsee the gaffe, though, in the effects? The one thing, that continuity error that bugs me every time? Okay, I'm going to unleash it for you and for those listening.
I'm going to unsee it. Endgame.
It's like DLP televisions in the rainbow that you never unsee.
So in the big fight, and it's obviously a very complicated logistic thing to storytelling thing to happen, right? Because there are so many of these characters, so many little fights going on, so many beats. But one of the beats, of course, in Endgame toward the end is Ant-Man. It's Scott Lang and Hope come in, and they have a great little nod. They tip their caps to Captain America, right? And they have they're like these plucky sidekicks who go on this mission to get the truck, right? They're the van, because the van has one of the teleportation devices that they want to send the gauntlet into, right? So they're both like in the van, and then you see they're doing that, and at the same time they cut to a big wide shot of all the action happening, and you have Ant-Man as a giant in the background also punching aliens. And I don't know if it was like an editing thing where they originally had that scene earlier or later.
Oh, I'm sure that's exactly right. What it was.
But it's Ant-Man, literally in one scene, he's in the van with Hope, and then at the same time, they cut to the wide, and he's in the back as a giant.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's I'll see it next time, but it won't bother me. The thing that I love about watching something so many times is that you start to watch for other stuff. You start to ping on other details, and then it starts to sink into you how many hundreds of thousands of person hours went into every one of these sequences. Like, you know, there's a meeting and drawings about this guy and these two together and this one. And I mean, probably every beat of that was some like vigorous meeting in which someone was a champion for some aspect of it.
And yet things fall through the cracks. You guys follow the filmmaker David Sandberg. He directed the horror films like Annabelle and then also Shazam. Okay. He makes great YouTube videos. Joe, you've seen those, right?
Yeah. He kind of started off with these horror shorts on YouTube and just had a filmmaking career. I don't know if it was because of that kind of launched him through into like some low budget or lower budget horror movies, and then became the director of a Shazam. But he still does great shorts just with like home equipment, home lights, his Blackmagic camera with his wife and him.
Nice. And in his YouTube videos, he explains, he does a great like just off the cuff breakdowns of things that he learned and little things that you might not have noticed and most people would never notice in a movie like Shazam, and tricks that are just standard editing tricks, like extending a scene by reversing and looping like 1-2 seconds of it just to extend, like slow down like a pan or something. And then and how like a effect scene, there's a big like fight scene in a mall in Shazam. You know, you can have 100 eyes on that from the day you shoot to going through edit and going through all the special effects, and no one will notice until very near the end that, like, in the crazy fight scene where like Shazam's being chased by Mark Strong, the crew are just standing on the side of the mall, just like literally clearly in the background hanging out, and they're like, oh shit, how do we fix this? Solution was to then paint in, CG in some like brooms and mops in their hands. So it looks like janitorial staff.
That is so awesome.
I have gotten myself in trouble with that technique. The stop, like extend the clip by reversing it a few frames and then coming back. So like it looks just kind of like a natural thing. I think it was in one of our drone videos, maybe. There was basically a sequence where I did that, but I didn't realize that there was water falling in the back, like a waterfall in a park. And so the water's coming down and whoop, whoop.
I did a live stream yesterday and someone was asking me about my favorite scene in Raiders. And I concluded that for me, my favorite action sequence is the the plane with the fist fight, the turning plane with the gasoline and the fist fight. And I talked about how much character Spielberg put into every beat for that. But I also mentioned how when the three of us were putting together and shooting Farewell to Arms in New Zealand, like, the moment you're on set and you realize, oh, I've got to get all the pieces of an action sequence, whatever that means, holy shit. And like, it's just, when you think about trying to do it on any kind of scale, it's crazy making.
Yeah. Yeah. And you kind of realize quickly, like, oh, that's why movies take a long time. Like, we need to choreograph this, but then also save everyone's energy and make sure no one gets hurt. And
choreograph not just the fight, but the camera, choreograph right. The beats, right? It's all of those cascades. We kept being asked questions and we'd be like,
no, sure. You guys shot Lord of the Rings. You tell us.
Yeah, exactly. We're literally shooting next to the tree Frodo hid from the ring wraith under. I'll kick off. So I've had a regular film that shows up in my mind about every month or so that I just need to see some frames from. And it's Alien. I watched it early on in COVID, and then I watched like Cameron's whole oeuvre, and I watched a bunch more Ridley Scott, but I keep coming back to Alien as in my head, an almost maybe the most perfect science fiction movie for me, for what I like out of them. And the scene I watched the other day is Brett's death scene, Harry Dean Stanton. And like I said, you know, going back into film, the things you see that you don't notice. I remember when Blade Runner, when the final director's cut came out and there's no narration, and I was sitting at the Embarcadero Theater watching it, I was totally amazed by how much more movie I was seeing because no one was talking at me. Like, once I didn't have narration filling my head with plot, I was like, are these new cityscape scenes? And they weren't. I had seen them like 50 times, but I didn't notice them until I saw it this way. And so watching Alien the other day, watching Brett's death scene, and you know, it begins with Brett, Parker, and Ripley missing the cat, and then Brett's got to go find the cat. And he walks slowly through several portals to get to the cooling tower of the Nostromo. And each one is like a bigger, and you realize this is Ridley Scott's second film. And as I start ignoring the plot and just looking at the rooms that they're filming in, those sets look like an Egyptian temple almost. Like, there's this incredible iconography to the way Ridley Scott sets up these repeating refrains. And then clearly goes on to, just by accident, inspire all of the music videos from the 80s, right? From Jamie's Got a Gun with the chains hanging down to all of these looks of the light casting through windows and being a visible beam through the dust and all of that. Like, it's so much of it is established right there. And I never get tired of the reveal of that alien's tail. And this time I noticed that there's a orchestra beat on the tail coming through. There's like a groom. There's a groom, kind of like a low piano note or something that corresponds with that first tail to give you that shiver.
So wait, just to go through the blocking of this, if I remember right, it's he's walking through and then we see like an opening with some rain or moisture coming down.
Yeah.
And I remember him looking up and closing his eyes, getting the water on, and you see the alien very static, hanging on the chains, just slowly swaying.
I didn't notice that.
There's like, I don't know what comes first. I think you do see some movement. I think that is that tail scene. And then it almost looks like it's part of the set. It's just these chains coming down and like some blocks of metallic stuff. And then the giant alien is like as still as can be, just slowly swaying back and forth. And then the next scene is where he kind of walks away and then it moves on, I guess, to him dropping.
So it's like Drax sitting there eating chips totally silently.
Like, I remember that being a haunting thing when I was a child. I mean, I kind of grew up with Aliens being the 80s kind of action flick, but I remember going back to that movie and being like, ooh, this is too scary for me.
Like, yeah, no, I gave the book about Alien, which I took out from the library in 1981, which was there's a book called The Book of Alien, and it's actually a reprint of the issue of Heavy Metal about Alien.
Wow.
I took it out of the library in 1981 and it gave me nightmares, just the pictures. in the book of all of Ron Cobb's and everybody's sketches of the blood turkey and all the different iterations of the alien. I didn't watch it until I was probably 16 because I was too afraid.
Well, it's all in your imagination, right? You're building up and you don't see the alien until that moment. I think some people think that even in that scene, it's the full body is too much. It's too much of the shark.
Yeah. You know, I've talked to two really great directors who I won't name, but both who felt that like every shot in Alien is perfect, save for the very last one of the alien hanging from the cable behind the Narcissus. That shows too much of the suit, but everything else is. So both my dad was a painter and an artist, and my sister, my older sister, is also a wonderful artist. And she was like 17 or 18 when the alien came out. And I remember asking both my dad and my sister to draw me pictures of what the alien looked like. And they both drew totally different pictures.
Interesting.
And I remember that spooking me, like, they were there. How can they not know? How can they not agree? What's going on?
Even the H.R. Geiger? Yeah, I had one of his books based off of the alien concept art when I was younger. And even flipping through that, I mean, all of his stuff had just, it was all slightly different than, you know, I guess what was on the screen eventually, but also what was in my mind. And like, there was this constant, like, kind of confusion that added to the horror aspect of that.
There's the last note of that scene, which is Brett screaming, and then his scream sort of descends into this kind of moan, like, no, as you hear him sort of disappearing up the conning shaft. I find that so, like, deliciously chilling.
Well, and also Jonesy, right? They keeps on cutting back to Jonesy's, like, and you're reading off the emotion of the witness of the emotion of the cat, and you can, it's like there's a, it's perfect that it's a cat, because there's that, like, you can't read the face, but also does the cat just not care also, right? There's, like, no reaction. It's just, like, kind of staring.
To me, you know the famous thing about, like, in a romantic comedy, when you want someone to like the main character, you have them save the cat.
The cat.
this is turning that completely on its head. How about you guys? Like, what are the, have there been scenes or movies that you guys return to for Sokor?
It's always Back to the Future for me.
Okay.
And that's just, it's chicken soup, that movie. Like, it's just the dialogue, all the beats of it roll so smoothly into each other. And it's all the fact that you recognize the Universal backlot, that whole, you know, the court square, when Mr. Sandman comes on, it's just like, it's very, very, it's a happy place.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe Crispin Glover's most normal role.
Yes. I was thinking of Charlie's Angels, and he was also in the Alice in Wonderland 2010 one.
Is that
what? The kid loves it. The 2-year-old loves it.
Is that one of the ones you watch every day?
It is in the list of one of the ones we watch every day. Yeah. Sound of Music, I guess, is one recently, and the kid loves that. And that one is I grew up with that, and it's also
which one? Sound of Music.
Sound of Music. Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, 1965. Yeah.
So I haven't been as much. I've been having like a real crisis of identity with movies lately. Like all the movies that I kind of used to watch, I've just. I'm either in like a slightly different headspace, either with having a kid or with the situation now. I'm like, I don't want to watch anything violent, which is a lot of the movies I used to have. Like Goodfellas was always a great like movie just to dive back into. But I've been really getting into all the movies that are just like hanging out, like right, like the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, like Ocean's 11, even like My Neighbor Totoro. I've been watching that with my daughter. I'm like, I'm just hanging out with these two girls and all these creatures. Like this is, I just want to be with these people that I like. Even like when Bill and Ted Face the Music came out, I'm like, oh, this is exactly what I need right now. I just need something really, not plotless, but something that's not, I guess, a dire or huge or scary, just something I can have and like kind of remember or, you know, remember it kind of a more of a fantastical version of the world where you're just kind of hanging out with your friends again and family. Well,
that hanging out vibe is really specific. It's a genre I hadn't considered before because Tarantino once said in an interview about Jackie Brown that that's the movie he made where he wanted it to feel like you were just hanging out with the main characters. And having watched that film like 8 or 9 times, every time I watch it, I feel even more like I'm just hanging out with Ordell right. and all of those dudes. But I hadn't considered that a genre, but you're totally right. There like, is, that is a kind of
Big Lebowski.
Isn't the main goal. And you spend a lot more time just learning about the dumb, weirdness of each of the characters.
Yeah. And even like the old, like, I mean, you're a Raymond Chandler fan, but like looking back, like The Big Sleep, it's like those kind of noir movies where it's, you know, Chinatown, like there was just one thing happening in the back, but it's really, you're spending a lot of time with like one or two people and kind of getting to know them and. There's something comforting in that right now for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
You guys feel like that's different than like a movie written by like a Mamet, like, you know, like a playwright where it's, it feels like it's on a stage and there's just like, you know, you're sitting in rooms with lots of pages of dialogue because that's what they write.
I actually went on a Mamet kick mid COVID and I watched Spartan, which is one of my all time favorite Mamets. And then I watched, oh my gosh, I am actually forgetting some of the Mamet films that I watched. But, oh, The Spanish Prisoner, which is just delightful. Have you never seen that?
I've never seen that. I've seen Spartan.
I'm a pretty big Mamet hole.
It's wonderful. Campbell Scott and Steve Martin is the villain.
Oh, and, interesting.
Yeah. And it's really, really eerie and slow plotted. And it's funny you bring up Mamet, Norm, because that's exactly what those spaces gave me. Spartan is one of my all-time favorite movies. And it's definitely my favorite Mamet film. And it's specifically because of what the characters say to each other while they're hanging out. Like there's this one point at which one character wants to figure out the big plot. And the other character says to him, no, don't figure it out. You got to set this mofo to receive. It's not a cost. It's a benefit. There's just like all this way in which they give you the mindset. So it's about a special forces trainer played by Val Kilmer who has to find the president's daughter. That's the basic plot. But like there are little sort of special forces bon mots he's always throwing. Like as they're moving, shadowing someone, he says, "In the city, in the woods, always a sound. In the city, always a reflection." And that's just like telling his young protege what to do. And the guy says, "What about the desert?" And he says, "You don't want to go to the desert." And then there's a callback to that line like an hour and a half later in the film. It's just great. But yeah, it is like that hearing that dialogue again always fills me with just like, oh.
And some people are critical of that because it is very, it feels very much like it belongs on the stage and right, the kind of Mamet speak that people talk about. It's like extra flourish that people, you know, have then riffed off on. You see a lot of that in
Aaron Sorkin. Kind
of. Sorkin for sure. What's his name? Shane Black. In those movies, and yeah, I love like the Nice Guys or
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Nice Guys. Absolutely. Those are two great.
Dude, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is so good.
Yeah.
So there's in theater, what you'd say, what I think you could say about Mamet is it's Brechtian, and Brecht was famous in theater for making theater that was about the making of theater. Right. The machinations were all on display and part of the display. So it's that meta commentary where you're not trying to like take people away. You're showing them that you're taking them away, but we're all clear that we're in this together. So it's a kind of a mannerist, obvious way of playing with the jokes. And Shane, like almost nobody's better at that than Shane Black, who's like my favorite jokes in movies are always when a character in the film says precisely what I'm thinking as a viewer. Like when the guy sees that thing
right
in the thing and says you gotta be effing kidding me.
The thing has a lot of great moments like that of what's his name just being tied up, and after that whole sequence of like just them testing and shit going haywire, that scene ends with him just like get me the fuck out of this chair. Like that's exactly the appropriate response that anybody would have.
Well, even Wilford Brimley in the shed, he's like, well, I don't want to be locked up no more.
That's great. About how you'd say it. Norm, do you have a repeated refrain?
Sometimes we play the game of turning on the TV and guessing which Fast film is on. It's like how quickly can you identify which Fast film this is, and then you know, watching the rest of it. And so there's a lot of hours in that. But yeah,
Fast films, one of your, like, once you get to it, you got to finish it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
There's just so many, and they're all good.
And they're the complete opposite of hanging out. They're like nothing but plot, 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 plot. Yeah. Action, sequel. Like, it's just, nonstop, made for, short attention span.
There was a tweet I made not too long ago comparing, like, the very first movie and, like, the latest movie. And it's, I mean, this is a movie about, the very first movie is about a bunch of street racers hijacking TVs from semi-trucks. And then the last movie, you have The Rock pulling a helicopter down from the sky with a rope, like, on the back of a truck. I'm like, these movies are gone way so far from their origin.
We, twice on Mythbusters, we came extremely close to doing the bank vault, two cars dragging the bank vault stuff.
Fast Five.
And like Fast Five in Rio, I believe it was. Yeah.
We came very close to it. It is nearly impossible to find a stretch of road, even that's like a mile and a half long, that someone would let you do untold damage.
You'd have to do it after the filming of a Matrix film, when they're ready to decommission the freeway that they built.
Just for that scene.
Well, I mean, that's the runway of Alameda.
Yeah.
I mean, it's exactly like that. And we were able, when we shot in Alameda, we were able to, I think the reason we couldn't film there was because Tesla had rented that runway for like 2 years solid to just continually do testing of their autopilot.
Fascinating.
Oh,
yeah. Huh. Logistics, how big, the making of that safe, like how would you go about making, like what would be the process to get a safe that would accurately represent what they had on screen?
So we would probably have done, I think the way we were looking at doing that is welding the safe out of plates of trench plate. Trench plate are those giant steel plates they put over road construction while they're not working on it. And you can rent those by the day, and they come with a big screw hook that goes in their middle, and they're well balanced, and you can pick them up and move them around with forklifts. They're actually really, we use them all the time, and we welded them to stuff all the time, because you just grind the welds and, you know, return them, and no one minds because you haven't really done anything to the structure. So we were thinking about welding it out of 1-inch trench plate, and then for weight, filling it with 55-gallon drums of water.
Oh my God.
Huh. Because that's a great way to have movable weight that doesn't kill you, in the transfers between things. Oh, wow. But we never even got to the stage of really plotting out how to make the safe, because we were just like, well, we want to drag something that's about 5 tons across the road. And everyone was like, nope.
Yeah. Oh, that's crazy.
Those were really,
trying to think
really
about that.
Some of the most fun mental exercises, which was like someone in a permit meeting would say, well, how would you build the safe? And then like Jamie and I would sit there and kind of you do it, and we'd come up with like 6 different ways, and the last way would be so ridiculously simple, like weld some trench plates and put some drums of water in it. But the first one was way more complex than it needed to be.
Joey, are you doing any film production these days?
Lately?
Yeah.
I actually did. I was up in the Bay Area. Speaking of 1990s music videos, I was in the Bay Area over the weekend shooting a music video for a metal band, and it was in a decrepit barn with lots of hard light coming through and rain and slow-mo.
There you go.
Hard lights hitting everything. It's interesting now, because production's happening again, and everyone's kind of wearing, everyone's being safe, wearing masks, but there still is a lot of insurance things to jump through. I know, like, we had 2 days that were very different than what eventually happened, because the crew had to be brought down quite a bit. The areas that we were shooting had to be cleared by like COVID compliance managers. So from my end, it's nice to, like, that you have at least production companies or insurance companies who are kind of keep an eye on making sure people are being safe and shooting correctly. But on the other hand, like, wow, definitely is, even when you're doing something with a production company, now it's feeling much more like, you know, back in the day, like a lot less people, bare bones crew, carrying everyone's
Interesting.
Lights and C-stands, a lot more hats being worn, which kind of speeds things up. But at the same time, like, you know, setups take a little longer.
So it feels like film school almost.
It does kind of feel like film school, except the the expectation of quality is still very high. Yeah.
I'm curious, across maybe two or three productions, are you finding the safety precautions to be consistent and that they make you feel safe?
Not so much.
Oh,
I did work on one where it was a little, you know, it's, I think it all kind of depends on how responsible the production company is. The music video company that I shot with, you know, they've been in the business for 20-25 years. So they know how things can go south really quickly if you don't kind of follow certain rules, especially when it comes to like working under, I mean, it was all non-union crew, but they've worked with union before. They know how to, like, you know, really iron out things. And then some of the, I guess, newer production companies, or even just like folks who have been hired, and then an AD is given the job of making sure people have the masks above their nose, can sometimes be a little bit less. So, you know, you have people coming at you talking real close, pulling masks down.
I can't believe that the nose thing is still a thing. It's making me crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. There was one set where it was a lot of chin diapers going on. A lot of, like, come on, guys.
Chin diapers. Thank you for that. It helps to have a phrase that speaks to a lack of respect.
Right, I think that's a South Park special.
Right? Chin diapers. Oh, I don't even want to think what South Park would do with that joke.
There's actually a really huge production happening just down the street from where I live. It's been going on for about 3 weeks now. And I kind of run through there, or one will buy every now and then. And they actually have it looks like they have check-in departments. So, like, the crew and cast come in, or the cast come out of their star wagons, and then you have, like, point A, and then you start there. You get your temperature, you get all of that stuff, and then you go to point B and, like, clean or get whatever equipment you need that's been sanitized. And so that, I mean, I don't know what – it looks like a feature film, but it looks like, you know, it looks like there is extra stops and extra trailers and stuff that are dedicated to just making sure people are, you know – being safe, because that's a pretty big crew and a lot of people to kind of be responsible for.
Yeah Crazy. Well, production's still happening, and we see, especially in TV shows, when they have to do, you know, lots and lots of shooting, many hours of shooting, and we heard that, you know, some of the TV shows that we like watching are moving on to, you know, like the Star Trek Discovery, moving on to season 4 production. Yeah. I think, you know, Disney said Mandalorian's moving into season 3 production at some point. And speaking of which, you know, at the end of this week, if you listen to this, speaking of comfort shows and content, you have Mandalorian season 2 coming out.
Yeah.
I didn't even watch that last trailer because I didn't need to. Yeah, I'm like, I'm sold on the show. We're on board, Joey. Finally. Yeah.
Have we talked about the West Wing special on HBO?
I would love to talk about that. I don't know, Joe, if you saw this.
I've never seen West Wing.
Yes. Okay. Adam, I would love to talk about that.
Just know stage. That it's the comfort food of the idea that someone in charge actually gives a shit.
And it ties everything we're talking about together in terms of it being Sorkin written for the stage. It is a modern production. They showed in the special the precautions they took. But to lay it out for people who don't know, you know, we're obviously big fans of West Wing. We talk endlessly when Will was on specifically, and it's been off the air for so long. And the cast they've come together a few times for small little things, you know, supporting causes here and there. But this is a full-blown HBO Max produced they call it a reading, but basically a performance of one of the famous episodes, Hartfield's Landing.
It's a really impressive interpretation, because it's more than a reading. It's less than a filmed episode, but it's pieces of both used really artistically in a way that, Joey, I'm really curious what you'd think about it, because the way they block it, it's like
How do you do a walk and talk?
It's exactly Brechtian. It's totally mannerist. They're not trying to hide the artifice of a stage at all. And yet you are in hook, line, and sinker right away.
Yeah.
The dialogue and the actors are all so great.
And they count on, I think Danica was saying this, it was very much in her mind because she'd seen this series and that episode so many times, almost like the difference between listening to the cast recording of Hamilton and then seeing it live or watching the live version, because the beats are all the same, but you're going to notice, if you're a fan of the show, the subtle differences in performance. And obviously everyone's two decades older now, or a decade and a half older now, but they bleed right into it. And then, of course, you know, because of John Spencer passing, they brought in
Vance.
The guy from
am I getting that wrong?
Yes. What's his name from Black Panther and the This Is Us show?
This Is Us.
It's Sterling K. Brown.
Sterling Brown.
Sterling K. Brown. Yes.
Sterling Brown.
Yes. Three names. Yes. Sterling K. Brown to come in
so
and perform that role.
Leo. It is. You imagine what it would be like as an actor to step into such an important role in such an important narrative. And man, he does something totally different with the role.
Yes. It's not an impression. There are moments where the character comes out and you can tell in the glances and like the pauses, but it's absolutely Sterling K. Brown.
And also my wife and I were chatting about this because there's a way in which John Spencer always had a kind of, I've got the power. And I know how to utilize it. Right. Like he's like the keeper of the keys. And there's a way in which Sterling Brown was like a little more open than Spencer was, but he made that work as that character. It was a fundamentally different approach to that kind of power.
Yeah. 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 The presence absolutely was there, and the cast, you know, he blended in with the cast perfectly well, even though this is all, again, chicken soup, because it is a series and actors and characters that we've seen for so long. But yeah, it's all done. I mean, it's not one take, right? So even though it's on the stage, they're filming these scenes.
Oh, they're doing elaborate camera work. They use that boom camera we saw on Afterlife, where they were getting so much mileage out of this one dolly with like a 40-foot.
Oh, right, the techno crane.
Huge techno cranes in theater.
And then there's some also really stunning, delicate Steadicam work that is just really a dance between the actors and the camera people that are really lovely.
They get those walk and talks, right?
It's so good. So I have an idea for a podcast that someone should take up. And you guys are in the thick of it because you've got young children. So you are watching the same movies week after week after week. This is a podcast kind of like those guys that watch Grown Ups every week.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So what it is, it's an interview with parents whose kids are now past the age where they watch the same movies every day. So like, you know, 7 or 8 year olds, and talking to the parents, like watching a movie that they had to watch a million times and going through it with a parent. Because for me, it's Willy Wonka, the original Willy Wonka. It's Teletubbies. It's a whole bunch of Miyazaki. But seriously, I think Willy Wonka, we probably watched every morning for a year. I mean, it was just unrelenting, and I'll never watch that movie again. But if you walked me through it, I'd have some choice things to say about certain scenes. This scene. Oh my God. Don't get me started.
And the emotions it evoked in your kids as you watch them.
I was just talking to Andrew about that almost that exact thing. But yeah, I go to sleep and wake up with like Moana and Frozen songs, just at a constant replay. But I was talking to Andrew about like what this is gonna be weird. Like as she kind of like gets, because she's already kind of moved a little bit on from Frozen to like other things. I'm like, what a weird thing. Like for us, for me and her, it's like this. It's gonna remain this nostalgic piece of film that she's gonna forget about in a few years. But for us, like we're gonna be reminded of this time of 1.5, 2 years old, and like it's a movie that none of us really. Damn, it's fine. No one like think it's great. Well,
that's the reason to sit, watch it with someone and talk to them about it as they're watching it. Cause none of us are ever going to want to voluntarily watch any of these movies again. We're not going to want to sit through them again. So force us. And I think there's all sorts of really interesting memories about parenthood and all of that stuff that are going to come up out of that.
Yeah.
My fear is that it becomes someone telling you their dream. It's so personal that no one can relate to it except the person telling it. And I'm just going to nod along. Yeah. Unless we all have the shared experience of watching that same movie. But yeah.
I was chatting with a friend the other day and he told me this dream that he had. And then I was talking about some comedian and I said, oh, well, do you mind if I tell you this joke that he told? And my friend goes, hey, I just told you my dream. So all bets are off.
Awesome. Well, that was a lot of things covered. I think, gosh, I wish I knew you watched the West Wing live special. I would have wanted to talk more about that.
We can talk about that in more detail, perhaps. But I think that the next spoiler cast has to be The Mandalorian. We'll be a month in. Yeah. In 4 weeks. So let's plan for our next spoiler cast to be talking about The Mandalorian.
Absolutely.
I hear there are some changes in the tech. I don't know exactly what they are, but I'm really curious to see the maturation of their process and their execution between the first season and the second season.
Totally. And is it a weekly show?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I'm happy for it. I don't need to binge right now.
Yeah.
No, when Watchmen was being played out, and I think also His Dark Materials was airing at the same time, and also I think Mandalorian was airing at the same time, I was having a great time noting which day of the week it was, and it felt like I was in my 20s again, and it was like, ooh, Thursday night, Seinfeld, yeah. Mad About You, Friends.
Especially at a time when, like, the weeks are all blending, like, what day is it? I've been wearing shorts and, you know, sweats for the last 5 weeks.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
All right. Well, good to see you, Joey.
And good to see you guys.
We'll reconvene in a month's time and talk about The Mandalorian. And folks out there, if you're listening, let us know what are your comfort movies and shows are. What are the scenes that you always go back to and the things that you notice and the favorite movies that we all love and watch.
And Joey, I was just going to say, I said this before the podcast, but I keep expecting I'm going to see your face reflected in the mirror behind you in the room there, Joey. I'm going to end up being unwittingly in a Joey Famelli horror show.
I'm shooting it right now.
What were you going to say, Joey?
Go vote. We have a few days.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Vote, everybody. Yeah. Vote.
Take care, and we'll see you next week.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, guys. Bye.